So our next speaker is the speaker. And we're really delighted to welcome Right Honourable John Bercow MP, the Speaker of the House of Commons, back to address an audience of voluntary and community organisations and activists in Northern Ireland. I don't think he needs much of an introduction, but I'll give one anyway. Mr Speaker was elected as the 157th Speaker of the House of Commons in June 2009. He's an MP for Buckinghamshire, where he's served since 1997. Mr Speaker has an interest in international development and human rights, like many other people in the audience. He served on the International Development Select Committee and was co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Burma, vice-chair of the All-Party Group on the Prevention of Genocide, Africa and Sudan, and secretary of the All-Party Group on Human Rights. And he also established an All-Party Group on Brain Tumours. The Speaker is married to Sally and they're proud parents to three young children. And even though we're officially obsessed with golf here at the moment, you'd be interested to know that at one time Mr Speaker was ranked as Britain's number one youth tennis player. So useful for batting backwards and forwards in the chamber, I'm assuming, and that's the last tennis pun I am going to make. I'm really delighted to welcome to share his thoughts on scrutiny and democracy. Please welcome the Right Honourable John Bercow, Speaker of the House of Commons.
Lisa, Mark, colleagues, thank you for the warmth and generosity of that welcome. It's a pleasure for me to return to an event hosted by the Northern Ireland Council for Voluntary Action. I had the privilege of engaging with you first, I think, in the summer of 2010, on the same day as I had the equal privilege of speaking at the UK Youth Parliament Annual General Meeting. So I have fond memories of both occasions, and that interaction with the voluntary sector is something of which we are always in my office in pursuit, if I can put it that way, because I am historically a fan of the voluntary and community sector. I recognise the freezing fiscal climate within which you are having to operate, but I'm also conscious of just how representative you are, how many people depend upon you, and how important your contribution to political and public policy-making debate is. You have not only got a substantial membership base, but you speak, I think, for a much wider and larger set of bodies and causes in Northern Ireland, and I guess there is a sense in which, in many instances, you're a voice for the voiceless. You are standing up on behalf of some of the most vulnerable people in the community, and I have to preserve political impartiality, but I don't have to be impartial about the merits and continuing importance of the voluntary sector. And the Political Studies Association itself, for whom you are acting in a sense as a fringe or the official fringe, is likewise an incredibly important organisation made up both of practitioners and of theorists, of people from academe, from politics, from journalism, from the world of research, from further and higher education to boot. So I'm delighted to be here. I would just like to lob into the pot, on the back of the excellent opening presentation from Mark, some thoughts about my chamber, my house, my institution, the House of Commons, in terms of its conduct and operation of scrutiny. First, question time is an important opportunity for scrutiny. And just to pick up on an important point Mark made about the difference between the House of Commons and the Northern Ireland Assembly in terms of the fact that there is a large official opposition in the UK and the number of members of the Legislative Assembly in Northern Ireland who don't come from one of the parties represented in the executive is much smaller. I note that, but I suppose the point I'd like to get across, and I hope it will resonate with people like Kevin who've served in Parliament in the past, is that scrutiny and representation are the responsibility of every member of the House of Commons. In other words, although of course you expect very often the sharpest of focused criticism to come from opposition members, that to some extent is the way of the world and what we would anticipate, the duty to scrutinise, to probe, to question, to examine, to challenge, to contradict, to expose and to hold to account the executive branch is a duty of every Member of Parliament, including, therefore, people who sit on the government side. Sure, they will come at it broadly from a vantage point of greater support for the government of the day because they come from the government party or parties. But that doesn't oblige them to agree with the government about everything, and significant numbers of backbenchers most certainly don't. And as I say, on behalf of their constituents, they've got a responsibility to question. So my first observation is that I have sought to speed up question time in the chamber day to day simply to facilitate greater and greater and greater participation. Now, whether I'm any good at the job of Speaker is not for me to say, that's for you and others to judge, but I have sought to do what it said on the tin and to insist upon shorter questions and, if I may say so, shorter answers so that more voices can be heard. Relatedly, on the subject of questioning as a means of scrutiny, I have championed, ladies and gentlemen, the reinvention or rediscovery of a long-established weapon in the parliamentary arsenal that had fallen into desuetude in recent years, namely the weapon of the urgent question, capital U, capital Q. It is a right of any Member of Parliament in the House of Commons to apply to the Speaker for permission to pose, as a matter of urgency, a question to the representative of a government department, to a minister, on a matter which that member judges to be urgent and requiring the attention of the House that day. In the year before I was elected Speaker, two urgent questions were granted by the Speaker, whose exclusive power it is either to grant or not to grant. In the 2 3/4 years since I was elected Speaker, we've had 91 such urgent questions granted by me on a vast miscellany of different topics spanning pretty well every government department, certainly the vast majority of government departments. And the reason why I've granted those questions is that I have felt they've warranted the attention that day of the House. And they will typically have been matters upon which I have thought, well, frankly, the government of the day, the last government, the Labour government, and this government, the coalition government, should have offered a statement to the House of its approach, its policy, its reaction to some important and urgent event, and it has declined to do so. But a member, usually but not always an opposition member, and it can be any member, has applied to me and said, Mr. Speaker, will you please allow us to question the minister today? And at short notice of no more than a couple of hours or so, a representative of that government department, I can't summon a particular minister, but I can insist that the department fields a minister, will have to appear to explain him or herself and to be open to questioning for 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 minutes. I can run it within reason as long as I think fit. And that will partly depend on the level of interest and demand, how many people want to take part, and what other business we have to consider. Now, I hope that that is thought to have conduced to a more lively and vibrant democratic exchange. And it has brought the advantage that members see they've got a chance, if they've got an urgent matter, of getting it highlighted. The media have to report the fact that the exchange is taking place in Parliament. I don't do it for the benefit of the media, but on the whole, the media also like it. And to some extent, it keeps ministers on their toes, knowing that they can be summoned at any notice. I am probably, ladies and gentlemen, veritably a dartboard in the offices of ministers' diary secretaries across Whitehall for making these decisions. But I hope you won't take it the wrong way or think it arrogant when I say that that is a matter of absolutely no concern whatsoever to the Speaker, because the Speaker's concern is to try to do the right thing by the House, by Parliament, by the elected representatives. And if that causes a certain amount of inconvenience to ministers, I'm afraid that's just too bad. Their duty is to answer first and foremost to the House. The content of the policy, the merit or demerit of the policy, that is not a matter for me. I have no view that I express about that. My concern is simply to facilitate scrutiny. Beyond questioning, I would say that a big development in this Parliament has been the creation and operation of what has come to be known as BBCOM, the Backbench Business Committee. Now, Mark referred rightly to the fact that the opposition in Parliament have certain days where they choose the business, typically somewhat in excess of 20 days a year, 25 days of the year or thereabouts, is the entitlement of the official opposition, and some of the minority parties have small opportunities also to choose the business for the day. But there's long been a sense that too much is controlled by the government and opposition whips, particularly the government whips, and there has been an appetite since before I stood for election as Speaker and during the speakership campaign for an assertion of parliamentary right and opportunity. And it is something that I championed very vigorously in the run-up to becoming Speaker. I'm pleased to say that through private cajolery and public exhortation, I managed to persuade the last government to ensure that the right committee report on parliamentary reform was debated and voted on before the election, and one of the elements of it was a call for the establishment of a backbench business committee. That now exists, and it chooses the business 35 days a year, and it will often choose to debate matters which the government and opposition themselves might not have chosen. So there's been a debate on the merits of a referendum on EU membership. There's been a debate on the merits or otherwise of the use of wild animals in circuses. There's been a debate on the Hillsborough disaster, one of the most passionate, least partisan and inspiring debates, I think, to take place in the course so far of this Parliament. There's been a debate on the so-called motor insurance racket. So I give you examples of subjects that might be hotly discussed outside the House, that might not be the subject of strong party divisions, and certainly that might not be the natural choice, let's take the EU referendum debate, of the government. The government might be, well, we don't want a debate and a vote on that, with some of our awkward squad causing trouble or threatening to rebel. But the House might want the debate. And I've been delighted to preside over those debates, and there are going to be a great many more of them in the years ahead. Another very important feature of our parliamentary scrutiny is not just legislative scrutiny, and we need more of that and arguably more pre-legislative scrutiny, but scrutiny by the select committees of the House. A further reform that was agreed in the run-up to the election and has taken effect in this Parliament is the reform whereby the chairs of the select committees of the House are no longer appointed by members of the executive, which it is their business to scrutinise, a frankly absurd arrangement that had outlived its usefulness. They are now elected, those chairs, by secret ballot of the whole House. So all of the key select committee chairs have the democratic legitimacy conferred by election, and arguably the appetite for greater assertiveness that results from the mandate that they now enjoy. And in the case of Northern Ireland, the select committee chair is elected by the House, Lawrence Robertson, and the members of the committee are elected by their respective parties. So it's no longer a prize or a punishment for good behaviour or bad to be put on a committee you do want to be on or a committee you don't want to be on by the whips. It's the choice of the House in the case of the chair and the choice of the parties as far as their party members on those committees are concerned. And the Northern Ireland Affairs Select Committee has produced a number of powerful reports on a range of different issues. The whole question of fuel smuggling, the issue of the impact on Northern Ireland of the Daylight Saving Bill, in other words, changing the clocks, and I think the hugely important issue of corporation tax levels and what that does to investment or disinvestment in the province. All of these matters have been entertained by the Select Committee, and I think in future the Select Committees, if anything, will demand greater opportunities for their reports to be debated. I point to you to other committees which have done important work in this Parliament, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, which is just completing its inquiry now into the phone hacking scandal. I think that the committee's report will be of huge interest, and the fact that the chairs are elected dramatically uprates the significance of the scrutiny. It's genuinely independent and seen to be independent of the government of the day. More widely, I'd like to put it to you in front of this Northern Irish audience that Northern Irish MPs across the piece, across the parties, are more actively involved, Lisa, as far as I can tell, in debate and scrutiny than they used to be. I have this image that in the past, Northern Irish politicians, and I'm not pointing to members of one party rather than another, were overwhelmingly preoccupied with and focused on the debate about the future of Northern Ireland. understandably, I'm not knocking them for that, but there was almost an irony, I hope the unionists won't take offence when I say this, when some of the unionist politicians who were keen advocates of full membership for Northern Ireland of the United Kingdom, full and undisputed membership, and in some cases they were advocates of integration within the UK, were nevertheless focusing really only on the debate about Northern Ireland and not taking that much interest in other matters. The great thing now about the Northern Irish members, from the Democratic Unionists to the SDLP to the Alliance Party and so on, is that they are engaging with other debates. Every day, Jim Shannon, a newly elected Northern Irish member, stays for the adjournment debate at the end of the day on a vast range of different topics. He stays and often intervenes. So nobody can say, well, Jim's interested only in Northern Ireland or only in his constituency. He engages much more widely. So does Nigel Dodds, so does Naomi Long, so does Mark Durkan and Margaret Ritchie and Alistair MacDonald. And if I may say so, I made this comment and apparently it's already caught fire around Northern Ireland. I was asked about notable parliamentarians. Sammy Wilson is a passionate parliamentarian. I'm not arguing for his politics or against his politics. I'm offering no view about that. I'm simply saying he's a very committed parliamentarian and he happens to be a very keen parliamentary speaker. And I think it's great when we see Northern Irish members not just talking about Northern Ireland and certainly not just talking about the peace process or the constitutionality of Northern Irish politics in the future, but taking part in debates on Burma, on Sudan, on special educational needs, on health and social care, on transport, on crime, etc. Surely that's what we want a participating member of a United Kingdom Parliament from whichever party or part of the UK to be doing. The last point I make is that I am an advocate and practitioner of outreach. I know it's a very ugly term. I've never found a better one. But I've tried to bring to the speakership the additional component, whilst retaining the traditional and valued impartiality of the chair as between one party and another, a role for the speaker as an ambassador for Parliament and a robust advocate of democratic politics. I believe in getting out and about, going right across the country, which I've been doing for the last 2¾ years, to every part of the UK to talk to people in schools, in colleges, in universities, in voluntary sector organisations, faith groups, charitable bodies of one sort or another, about the role of the Speaker, the functions of Parliament, the way in which we're changing, and the importance of engagement with the political process. And I do feel it helps me to do my job if I've got a better sense of what is making you tick. And I would like to underline the importance of your involvement and engagement with our parliamentary outreach service, represented by my colleague Claire Cowan, who is here today. We have a service dedicated to explaining the bill process, the passage of a particular piece of legislation, the opportunities for you to lobby and seek to influence the content of the measure. Now, obviously, that service is impartial. It doesn't argue for or against a particular bill, but it says, please engage with us. We want an engaged populace. We want a genuine and dynamic interaction between Parliament and people. I think that's quite enough from me, and you'll be mighty relieved to know that my speech, which has been a great privilege to be able to deliver to you, is at an end.